The public interest includes the nation's commitment to land reform and to reforms to bring about equitable access to all South Africa's natural resources, and B, property is not limited to land. Sub 5, the state must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resources to foster conditions which enable citizens to gain access to land on an equitable basis. Sub 6, a person or community whose tenure of land is legally insecure as a result of past racially discriminatory laws or practices is entitled to the extent provided by an Act of Parliament either to tenure which is legally secure or to comparable redress. Sub 7, a person or community dispossessed of property after 19 June 1913 as a result of past racially discriminatory laws or practices is entitled to an extent provided by an Act of Parliament either to restitution of that property or to equitable redress. Sub 8, no provision of this section may impede the state from taking legislative and other measures to achieve land, water, and related reform in order to redress the results of past racial discrimination, provided that any departure from the provision of this section is in accordance with the provisions of Section 36(1). Sub 9, Parliament must enact the legislation referred to in subsection 6. In respect of the summary of the history of the bill, it is worth it to note that the cabinet approved that the Expropriation Act of 63 of 1975 should be reviewed on 15 September 2004, and in 2015. The Minister of Public Works submitted the expropriation bill to Parliament. I think we have chosen 2015 because that was when the bill was taken through the entire process up to the end. So the bill was passed in 2016, the bill was passed in 2016, and after it was passed, there were some representations which were made by the Institute of Race Relations to the President, and following that, the President remitted the bill to Parliament in February 2017. And this was followed by it being referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders by the Portfolio Committee at that time. And I think this coincided with the establishment of the Joint Parliamentary Constitutional Review Committee on Section 25 on 27 February 2018. But then I think the date there is not correct. It was on 4 September 2018 when the Portfolio Committee on Public Works rejected the bill for reintroduction at a later stage. You can move the slide, please. The bill was gazetted for public comment on 21 December 2018 for a period of 60 days. Approximately 50,000 written responses were received. And the majority of those were one-liners, where people were just saying that they were against the bill. But then we received a reasonable number of written submissions from a variety of organizations and individuals who made inputs. And those inputs are summarized as annexures 1 and 2 to this presentation. We have, in the course of drafting the bill, been ably assisted by councillors Batlenda and Naidu with regard to, you know, the technical legal drafting advice. You can move on to the next slide. Other consultations took place. We consulted with the Department of Penny Monitoring and Evaluation in respect of the socio-economic impact assessment. We consulted with other departments, key departments. There were about five. We also later on consulted with, starting from, I think, from the 5th of December to March 2020 with the National Economic Development and Labour Council. The NEDLEC, as we all know, comprises of labor, business, community, and community organizations, including government. In September 2020, the bill was presented to Cabinet. Cabinet approved the gazetting of the bill for submission to Parliament, and thereafter, the Chief Office of the Chief State Law Advisor certified the bill and observed that the bill was consistent with the Constitution. On the 9th of October 2020, the bill was gazetted as already stated and submitted to Parliament. We may proceed to the next slide. The bill seeks to repeal the Expropriation Act of 1975 to provide a uniform framework which is in line with the Constitution to guide expropriation of property by organs of state. And it also provides for instances where nil compensation may be payable. As indicated, the bill, the Expropriation Act, which is being reviewed currently, dates back to 1975, and recently, as recent as I think 2019, the Presidential Advisory Panel on Land Reform, in its report, pointed that the 1975 Act is inconsistent with the Constitution, and that the Act undermines the constitutionality enshrined by principles of lawfulness, procedural fairness, and reasonable administrative justice. One of the objectives that this bill seeks to achieve is actually to bring certainty, and I think an area that would benefit there would be investment, where investors may invest freely knowing that there is certainty in that area. The bill is also meant to assist all organs of state in the three spheres of government to expropriate in the public interest for reasons connected with their functional areas of legislative competence. You may proceed to the next slide. One of the cornerstones of the proposed legislation is that holders of unregistered rights will be treated on an equal and procedurally fair basis when their property is expropriated. The current bill, which is B23-2020, retains most of the substantive content that was contained in the bill that was rejected in 2018. But now an innovation is the new clause 12, 3 and 4, which deals with instances where it may be just and equitable to pay nil compensation for the expropriation of property in the public interest. The Constitution provides that compensation for expropriation must be just and equitable, as stated above, having regard to all relevant circumstances. The bill outlines circumstances when it may be just and equitable for nil compensation to be paid. It does not prescribe that nil compensation will be paid in this circumstance. I think the next sentence there wanted to say that where there is a dispute, then on compensation, such dispute may be referred to the court. Not that the courts will be the ones that determine compensation. You may, okay. Now we will go to the contents of the bill itself. Chapter one deals with definitions and application of the Act. Clauses 1 and 2 contains definitions and deal with the application of the proposed legislation, determining that an expropriating authority may not expropriate property arbitrarily or for a purpose other than a public purpose or in the public interest. The expropriating authority is obliged to enter into negotiations with the owner of the property or attempt to reach agreement before resorting to expropriation, except in circumstances where the right to use property temporarily is taken on an agent basis in terms of clause 22. An expropriating authority may not expropriate property of a state-owned corporation or state-owned entity without the concurrence of the executive authority responsible for that corporation or entity. The bill proposes that no property may be expropriated unless the prescribed procedures have been followed. You may proceed to the next slide, please. Chapter 2 deals with powers of the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure to expropriate. These clauses 3 and 4, grant a general power to expropriate to the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure, including expropriating on behalf of an organ of state at its request. The Minister's power of expropriation applies to property required for the provision and management of the accommodation, land, and infrastructure needs of organs of state within the confines of a mandate. The minister may delegate or assign his or her powers and duties contained in the legislation to an official of the department, except the power to expropriate agently on a temporary basis, withdraw an expropriation, or make regulation. May I proceed to the next slide, please? Chapter 3 deals with investigation and valuation of property. Clauses 5 and 6 sets forth the procedure that must be observed by an expropriating authority prior to expropriation. This includes investigation, access to the subject property, and the information required. Provision is also made for a person to claim reasonable compensation should the subject property be damaged following an inspection or assessment of value. The bill further provides for consultation with other public authorities who may have an interest in an expropriation. May I proceed? Chapter 4 deals with intention to expropriate and expropriation of property. Clauses 7 to 11 provides for the nature, timeframes, publication, and service of a pre-expropriation notice or notice of intention to expropriate. Objections, representations, compensation claims, or any other submissions are catered for. Notice to expropriate follows where the decision to expropriate is taken. The nature, timeframes, publication, and service of the notice to expropriate must comply with specific requirements. The notice to expropriate must be accompanied by documents detailing the proposed date of payment of compensation, what constitutes the offer of compensation, survey diagrams or sketch plan of the subject property, ownership or holdership of rights, and where compensation is offered is disputed, the expropriating authority must indicate that the owner or holder may institute legal proceedings or request that the expropriating authorities to commence such proceedings within 1 day. If I heard the minister correctly, I thought she stated that advocate but lender would proceed from here. Am I right?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister, and thank you, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. I've been asked to deal with the part of the presentation that deals with compensation for expropriation, and that's in clauses 12 to 20, which generally deal with compensation for expropriation. What these clauses do is they set out the requirements of section 25(3) of the Constitution, which Mr. Lakala has spoken about. And they set the standard for all expropriations which are to be undertaken by an expropriating authority in the three spheres of government. As we know, as has been referred to, but I think it's worth repeating, the overarching requirements for the determination of just and equitable compensation is in section 25(3) of the Constitution. The court must decide what is just and equitable compensation. And just and equitable compensation is decided on having regard to all circumstances, all relevant circumstances, which include five listed circumstances: the current use of the property, the history of the acquisition and use of the property, the market value of the property, the extent of direct state investment and subsidy in the acquisition and beneficial capital improvement of the property, and the purpose of the expropriation. And those factors are repeated in clause 12(1) of the bill. What is new in the bill in this regard is the explicit provision in clause 12(3), A to E, which sets out relevant circumstances which may result in the payment of nil compensation. If I can interrupt the written presentation and just say something about that, because that really is what has been so far the most controversial part of the bill. I think there is virtually all serious legal commentators agree that it is possible under the Constitution that in a particular case or in particular cases, it will be just and equitable for nil compensation to be paid. Virtually every serious commentator who has commentated on the bill has agreed that the Constitution does permit nil compensation to be paid if that's just and equitable. In my opinion, the provisions of the bill are consistent with the Constitution in providing for this for the following reasons. Firstly, the bill says, it repeats what the Constitution says, that compensation will be just and equitable. Secondly, it says that in some cases, no compensation may be just and equitable. It doesn't say it will be in all cases in those categories. It says it may be just and equitable in those cases or in other cases. And thirdly, it says that if there is a dispute about compensation, the amount of compensation is determined by the courts in accordance with Section 34 of the Constitution. So in summary, what Clause 12(3) does is that it identifies some categories of cases in which compensation may be null. It doesn't say that it will be null in every one of those cases. It says that it may be null, and that if there's a dispute, the courts will decide whether it will or will not be null. Similarly, it doesn't limit the cases in which compensation may be null. There may be others, and if there's dispute, that will be determined by the courts. And so to go to the last bullet point on the previous page, please. What the presentation points out is that the payment of nil compensation, that should say may, not will, the payment of nil compensation may, in such a situation, I see it's been corrected, I apologize. The payment of nil compensation may, in such a situation, be regarded as just and equitable after satisfying the balancing of rights process and the requirements of Section 25 and 36 of the Constitution. 25 is the clause, the section we've been looking at, property rights. Section 36 deals with the question of when it is permissible to limit a right in the Bill of Rights. So if we can go over the page then, Clause 12.3 therefore lists relevant circumstances that may justify the payment of nil compensation. It says that they include, in other words, they're not limited to, these are examples of where it may be the case. Firstly, where the land is not being used and the owner's main purpose is not to develop the land or use it to generate income, but to benefit from appreciation of its market value. And that's really a statement of what's sometimes called the use it or lose it principle. It's the same principle as you find in the Minerals Act, the MPRDA, that if you have an asset, a valuable asset of this kind, which is in public demand and for which there's a shortage, either you must use it or you must allow somebody else to use it. If you sit on it just hoping that the price will go up one day, you are at risk of an expropriation which may give you less compensation than you'd hoped for. Secondary circumstance is where an organ of state holds land that it is not using for its core functions and is not reasonably likely to require the land for its future activities in that regard, and the organ of state acquired the land for no consideration, in other words, for free. Thirdly, notwithstanding registration of ownership in terms of the Deeds Registries Act, where an owner has abandoned the land by failing to exercise control of it. We know that there are cases of that kind where owners have abandoned the land, do not in fact wish to resume use of the land, and the land stands there, and the question is what, if it's to be expropriated, what the compensation should be. The bill says that it may be nil compensation in such circumstances. I repeat that it may be, not that it necessarily will be. The court will have to look at the facts of the case. Fifthly, where the nature or condition of the property poses a health, safety, or physical risk to persons or other property, and obviously the most obvious example of that is degraded urban properties. So then we can go to Clause 13. Clause 13 makes provision for the payment of interest on any outstanding amount of compensation once the right to take possession of the property has passed to an expropriating authority. The general principle is that the compensation will ordinarily be paid at the time of the notice of expropriation, because ownership passes when the notice of expropriation takes effect on the date specified in the notice. There will be circumstances in which full compensation is paid only later. For example, if there's a dispute about it, in that event, there's interest is to be paid as well. Clauses 14 and 15 create a mechanism for trying to resolve a dispute about a compensation. Clause 14 imposes obligations on an owner or affected holder of a right who receives a notice of expropriation. The owner must within 20 working days indicate whether he or she agrees to or rejects the amount of compensation offered. If they reject the offer, the owner or holder must indicate the amount that they claim as just and equitable compensation. And then Clause 15 provides that if the expropriating authority rejects the amount claimed, it must within 20 working days make an offer of just and equitable compensation and furnish details of how the amount is made up and calculated. So there has to be an exchange of positions between the parties. And Clause 16 provides for certain particulars an expropriating authority or claimants may request regarding the compensation claims and offers. Excuse me. Clause 17 deals with the payment of the amount offered as compensation. As I've noted, in essence, compensation becomes due on the day on which the right to possession of the expropriated property passes to the expropriating authority. That's consistent with what the Constitutional Court has said should usually be the position. Not an absolute rule, but that should usually be the position. Clause 18 provides for instances where the expropriated property is subject to a mortgage or a deed of sale. Provision is made to whom payment of the compensation must be made, subject to agreement and not to notification. In a dispute, the compensation money may be deposited with the Master of the High Court. Clause 19 makes provision for the expropriating authority to pay out of the compensation money any outstanding property rates and other charges relating to the expropriated property. So the municipality effectively has first call on the compensation money, which is not a new principle in our law. And then clause 20 now deals with situations where there's a dispute as a, or the beneficiary can't be traced. The compensation money can be deposited with the master of the high court who looks after it until the matter is resolved. Then on the next page, I want to deal briefly with chapter 6, clause 21, which deals with mediation and determination by the court. This is important, and it provides for the settlement of a compensation dispute by mediation or a competent court. I'd like to interrupt myself here and say that the principle which the bill seeks to give effect to is that if the parties want to mediate, they can do so. But there's no obligation to mediate. Mediation is a voluntary process. The parties can agree to sit with a mediator, usually a third party, to help them to try to reach agreement. But there's no obligation to go to mediation. Parties can go directly to court if they prefer not to that, prefer not to mediate. And perhaps, can I just say that I think on reflection, clause 21 may need a little workshopping or fine-tuning, because it's not altogether clear in that regard that that this is a purely voluntary process, mediation. Members, honourable members may want to have a look at that. So what it provides, and if there's a dispute, the matter can be resolved by a court. That gives effect to Section 34 of the Constitution, which provides for the access to courts. And it provides, the clause provides, as it has always provided in our law, that the existence of a dispute in respect of compensation or the application of the Act doesn't suspend the decision by expropriating authority to expropriate the affected property. And the reason for that is that when property is acquired by the state by expropriation, it's because it's needed for a public purpose or a public interest. And one doesn't want to create a situation where an owner can obstruct the process indefinitely by raising a dispute about compensation and taking it through the courts from A to Z. That can be taken through the courts. There's a right to take it through the courts. But in the meantime, the property can be expropriated. The transfer of ownership can carry on, and the use of the property can take place while the dispute about compensation is being resolved. And the last bullet makes the point that the vesting of ownership and possession in terms of clause 9 of the bill following the decision to expropriate remains valid while the compensation is being fought out in the courts. There's finally one other matter to which I would like to draw the attention of the honourable members. And that is there were submissions received about the question of who has to go to court if there's a dispute. And there were really a variety of views on that. Some people said, well, if the state is expropriating, the state should have the burden and the initial expense of going to court.
Okay, thank you.
Other people said, no, the owners must always have the right to go to court if they're raising a dispute. And so what the bill provides is that either party can go to court if they raise a dispute about the compensation, but the owner can say, well, I'm not going to go to court. I want the process to be initiated by the expropriating authority, and then the expropriating authority will do so. It doesn't affect the outcome in any way. It just means that if people's property is expropriated and they say they don't have resources to go to court, they can say the expropriating authority should trigger the litigation in the court. Chairperson, those are my contributions.
Ioannis, you may continue.
Thank you, Chair. We will proceed to the Chapter 7, which deals with agent expropriation. It provides that an expropriating authority may exercise a right to use property temporarily if it is urgently required for a period not exceeding 12 months. This power is available only if there is no suitable property held by three spheres of government. Agent expropriation circumstances are clearly determined under the two broad categories in the bill. Firstly, where it has to do with the Disaster Management Act or an order of court. Just and equitable compensation must be paid to an affected person when an agent expropriation the power to the period of temporary use may not exceed the maximum period of 18 months from the date of agent expropriation. The expropriating authority may proceed to expropriate the property subject to an agent expropriation permanently. In this regard,
to even aid public works.
Miss Martinez, I can speak with these people from Parliament. They are making a lot of noise. Okay. Continue, Mr. Likala.
In this regard, the relevant provisions of the bill for this purpose must be complied with. You may proceed to the next slide, please. Chapter 8 deals with the withdrawal of an expropriation. Clause 23 authorizes an expropriating authority to withdraw an expropriation if the withdrawal is in the public interest or the person for which the property was expropriated is no longer, the reason for which the property was expropriated is no longer applicable. The bill does not permit the withdrawal of expropriation under certain specified circumstances. For instance, where 3 months has already elapsed from the date of expropriation, or where the property has already been registered in another person, or where compensation had already been paid, unless the consent of the affected party is obtained. The bill spells out clearly the consequences of the withdrawal of an expropriation. You may proceed, please. Clause 24, under Chapter 9, which deals with general matters, related matters. Clause 24 deals with the service of documents, delivery thereof, and publication of the various expropriation notices. This includes the use of radio and television to communicate with affected persons. The bill further provides guidelines on the language aspect. If I may just say something on this, if you go to the specific provisions in the bill, you'll realize that it says the language that may be used is English and any official language that is dominant in that area. So it makes provision for, you know, official languages. It does not really limit in respect of languages that may be used. Clause 25 empowers an expropriating authority on written request and good cause shown by an owner or holder of a right to extend any period prescribed in legislation within which such owner or holder has to do something. The extension of time must be subject to the dictates of reasonableness. Clause 26 requires the Department of Public Works to establish and maintain a register of all expropriation, which must be accessible to the public. So the register should have all notices of intended expropriations, decision not to proceed with an intended expropriation, notices of expropriation, and notices of withdrawal of expropriation. Thank you. You may proceed to the next slide, please. Clause 27 deals with civil fines resulting from the failure to provide information or documentation as prescribed by the bill, and offences relating to willful furnishing of false or misleading information by property owners or holders of a right. Clause 28 empowers the Minister of Public Works and Infrastructure to make regulations regarding any matter that may or must be done. the draft regulations must be published for at least 20 days to solicit public comments. Clause 29 provides authority to an expropriating authority to correct non-material administrative errors where no person is prejudiced. Decisions taken pursuant to the bill which falls short of certain procedural requirements are rendered valid by this clause. This is, again, another innovation which has been taken from the National Environmental Management Act, similar to a provision in the National Environmental Management Act. You may proceed to the next slide, please. Clause 30 is the supremacy clause. It provides that this bill shall prevail in the event of a conflict with any law that provides for expropriation. This clause further provides an interpretation guideline which seeks to achieve consistency and harmonization of
clause 31. Excuse me, Mr. Johannes, can you please raise your voice? Members of the committee are raising a matter that your voice is too soft, they can't hear clearly. Remember, we also have challenges of the network in our areas. If you can just raise your voice. Thank you.
Thank you. I will do that. I will go through clause 30 again. Clause 30 is the supremacy clause. It provides that this bill shall prevail in the event of a conflict with any law that provides for expropriation. This clause further provides an interpretation guideline which seeks to achieve consistency and harmonization of laws. Clause 31 repeals the Expropriation Act of 1975. Clause 32 provides for transitional arrangements and savings. And clause 33 sets out the title of the bill and how the bill will come into force. You may proceed. Oh, that was the last slide that we dealt with. May I take this opportunity to thank you, Minister and Honourable Members.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Minister, a legal team, acting DG, and your team for a presentation that is detailed. I am now inviting Honourable Members to deliberate on this report. Honourable Siwisa, Honourable Graham Murray, Honourable Hicklin, according to that order, as I see their hands. Thank you.
Oops. Sorry, Chair. Sorry about that, Chairperson. Chair, my question would be on the urgent expropriation. Because if I look here, the expropriation for temporarily for 12 months, it says that expropriation authority may exercise the right to use property temporarily if it is urgently required for a period not exceeding 12 months. Is that not going to open for more exploitation whereby we'll find the bill is going to open for every time we'll be told that this is a temporary expropriation. The next thing we'll find out that it moved from 12 months, it's already 5 years. It's been temporarily under urgent expropriation. I don't know, maybe they can just explain in detail. And then there's a section again, bulletin 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on slide 20. The period for temporary use may not exceed the maximum period of 18 months. And then bulletin 1 says not exceed for 12 months. I don't know if there's a difference between those two. And then clause 30 is the supremacy clause. Can I get a thorough explanation? What do they mean that it's a supremacy whereby in the event of a conflict of any law that provides for expropriation? Because we know that the Constitution is the supreme law. So how do the two fit into each other? Does it mean that this clause itself as the supremacy law is going to rule out any other? Supremacy clause, is it overriding any other law that is out there? For now, those are only my clarification questions, Chair. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. My first question is a question really of general information around this. I'm a new MP. This is my first term and the first time I'm dealing with legislation. So my general question is, what is the threshold for inputs that would render a bill unworthy to be processed any further? So what you said was that there were 50,000 inputs made on this bill. And the bulk of them, or a majority of them, were one-liners that said that they opposed the bill. At what point do you say, okay, well, there seems to be a general consensus that there's opposition to this bill, and as a result, we need to withdraw it, or we need to look at revising it, or whatever. So that's just I'm just trying to understand, what is the point of public participation if we have 50,000 inputs, the bulk of which say we don't want the bill, but we ignore everybody and we just proceed anyway. So if I could just get clarity on that. And then just with respect to the compensation, the nil compensation, I just have two questions, really. The one is, where it says where the land is not being used and the owner's main purpose is not to develop the land or use it to generate income, but to benefit from appreciation of its market value. What is the measurement with respect to whether or not a person is waiting for that land to appreciate? Who determines that? Who determines the point at which this is not just an investment? Maybe they want to hold on to it and give it to their children in the future. So under what mechanism is it determined that that is the only reason why that person is holding on to that land? And also, It will disincentivize investment in property. Now, I understand that we're looking at land redistribution, and I fully appreciate that this needs to be done. So I'm certainly not disputing that. But if we are disincentivizing investment in property, will that not have an economic impact going forward? Because then people will not buy property as an investment anymore, because there's the risk that it'll be expropriated if they're not using it. And then the other issue I have is where they talk about the ownership failing to exercise control over the land. So that now is again a measurement of whether or not that land is suitable for expropriation. We have a massive problem in this country with land invasions, like a massive problem where nobody's actually doing anything to protect the landowner. So there are cases where people have just invaded property and the landowner has absolutely no control over that property anymore. Is that land then available now for expropriation, and who determines that is the case? So what is the measurement for no control over the property? Is it if somebody has now taken over the property despite them having, you know, tried to protect their rights? So suddenly your title deeds mean less than actual physical control of your property. And is that actually fair and equitable and legal? Thank you very much.
Honourable Tiglin.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for the presentation. Minister and the committee, my biggest fear with this expropriation bill is one of my hobby horses, you all know, is the immovable asset register. In this immovable asset register, we have huge tracts of land. I think, if memory serves me correctly, it's in the region of about 85,000 hectares or something. That's the number that's kicking around in my mind, which can be made available immediately. This is DPWI acknowledged own land that can be made available right now in rural as well as provincial, within rural and provincial areas, that can be used for the very purpose that expropriation without land is designed to be used for, as I understand it. And that is to redress the imbalances of the past by making sure that people have title, by enabling people, particularly subsistence farmers, for example, to be able to start earning a dignified living all of their own. This resides entirely in the hands of the DPWI, and as we know, little, if anything, has been done to actually expand on where those parcels of land really are. I mean, there's a story that was told to me about coordinates being supplied for a piece of land owned by the DPWI, and it actually turned out to be in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, because there's no immovable asset register that is concrete and that is complete and that anyone can have any faith in. Now we are asking to add an additional register into the hands of the Department of Public Works and Infrastructure, that being land identified for expropriation without compensation. Added to that is the need for the details of the owner of that land to be added to that that register, and then to track the process. We can't get the first register going properly. How are we going to get the second register going? Another thing that is concerning for me, the allocation of these pieces of land lies entirely within the hands of the minister, according to this expropriation bill. How fair is that, that one person, because ultimately it is going to be one person, determines whether my right to the land is superseded by Honourable Suwisa or Honourable Van Staden or Honourable Majobo's claim to that same piece of land. We may all have exactly the same modus operandi, we may have the same motivations. How can one person be allocated the authority to determine and be judge, jury, and executioner over decisions taken with regards to expropriation? I also want to say one thing. Slide 16 speaks about the organ of state exercising its rights and being the custodian, so to speak, of land. The organ of state has a lot of land that is available, as I've said. Why don't we start there before we start looking at other areas of expropriation? And what mechanisms do we have in place, or will we have in place, in terms of this expropriation bill and for the upliftment of land, that it goes to the people who need it, that it goes to the people for whom it is meant, as opposed to going to people who are connected individuals? These are major flaws as it stands right now that I think we need to address as a committee. We need to make sure that your average South African who has to benefit from this expropriation bill is covered by the bill itself. I'll leave it there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Hicklin. I don't see any other hands. I don't want to leave someone out. If there is...
Sorry, Chair. Can I say something? I'm struggling here with my network.
Okay. Honourable Kopane, please continue. And any other member who can't raise the hand on the device, Can that member please indicate? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've been covered by most of my colleagues, but I just wanted a clarity in terms of the overview of the public participation process. We were just informed that the Department of Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation was consulted on the socioeconomic impact of the bill. But with the presentation going forward, it saw silence about that impact analysis, because for me, for any bill to be implemented or for any piece of legislation to be implemented, we need to know the socioeconomic impact. But it saw silence about this. Maybe can we be given the report? When was the, do they have that study? Can we be given that the impact analysis? And how is it going to affect the implementation of the entire bill? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Kopane. Any other member? Before I ask the team, the legal team and the minister to respond on the issues that have been raised.
Chairperson, if I my video is keeping off.
Okay.
I can't hear you, but I'm going to try. Maybe you can hear me. I heard part of what the previous colleagues said just before me, and I agree with her. We must get a report like that also. But I have just one question. If you can hear me, when are we, the ministry planning to start with this consultative process with a public consultation? Specifically on this bill, which we are busy now, is it early, going to be early next year, or are we still planning on this program? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Van Staden. Minister and DM and the legal team, just a few things on my side, is that the bill was introduced in the fifth term, as all the speakers have indicated, and then it had to be rejected in the parliament, and now it is coming back. I think the legal team has presented that there were challenges with clause. In fact, there is an addition of two clauses that people were contesting the last time. I think clause 12.3 and 12.4 are the new additions at this time. So mine would be, are these new additions that have been added? I think someone indicated that it has gone to NEDLAC. All the processes that when the bill is going to be introduced, it has to go through, especially on the executive side. Now it is being tabled to us as the committee. So then maybe the legal team can also assist. I think it's coming closer to what Honorable Staden has been asking, that then it is now up to us as the committee to go again and seek and do the public participation, where we consult people through public hearings, so that it goes that route. Or because there are only these two additions, it just goes to Parliament. I just want to clarify on that one. Otherwise, on the issue of the wording and that, I know that there is a process that has to be followed. Thank you. Minister, over to you.
Yeah. Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and members for the input. Honourable Chairperson, now that we have introduced the bill to Parliament on the 9th of October, it is up to Parliament in terms of Parliament rules and regulations to decide whether you want to do public hearings. That's completely in your right. From the department side, from December 2018, like we said in the introduction, until March, I think, 2019, the public participation took place. And then from there, in drafting the bill, the input from the public were considered.
And that is why I think attached to the presentation today is an NXJA where we are making that available to the portfolio committee to see what transpired during that process, because we categorize the 50,000 inputs into different categories. And that is certainly available, Chairperson. I just want to come back to, and I'm sure the legal team will explain further, but I just want to also come back to Honorable Yeakland about the immovable asset register, which we briefed the portfolio committee on last week. And like we explained before, that when we speak land reform includes a redistribution, restitution, land tenure, and expropriation. Expropriation is but one mechanism for acquisition. But it's not totally correct to say that there was no land redistribution. We've just seen recently that the Minister of Land Affairs, Minister Toka Didisa, made available over 700,000 hectares of land for agriculture. Last year, October, Cabinet approved 14,000 hectares also for human settlement purposes. DPWI also released almost 200 pieces of land for land restitution. So it is an all-encompassed process, and that the Presidential Advisory Panel and the recommendations that they've made, 85% of those recommendations were accepted by government. So it is not just that land reform is just about expropriation. Expropriation is about one mechanism for acquisition that we can use if and when it's needed. And the bill spells out how it can be done. As it stands currently, the president has got powers to expropriate all 9 premiers in the country, all 9 provinces. All municipalities have got powers to expropriate, and also at least 7 national ministers. What was absent was a law of general application that can bring consistency, which was not provided for in the 1975 Act that this bill seeks to repeal. So the question to say it is only the minister that's going to decide is not correct. But I will leave the legal questions for the legal people to answer, Chairperson. I don't know who wants to start first. Honorable
Naidoo? Chairperson, if I may start, I will do so. I'll ask my colleague, Advocate Naidoo, to deal with the question of required public consultation.
Yes.
If I can then deal, I think it's important to start at the beginning. And to recognize, the beginning is to recognize that in probably every country in the world, the law permits the state to expropriate property. This is not a peculiarly South African provision. It exists everywhere that the state is allowed to expropriate property for the public good. And there's nothing really controversial about the principle of expropriation. It's called different things in different countries. In the United States, they call it eminent domain. In the former British colonies, they usually call it compulsory acquisition. Because it has different names in different countries, but everywhere in the world, property can be expropriated for the public good by the state. And so everybody who owns property is, in theory, has the risk of their property being expropriated. The house where I'm sitting at the moment could be expropriated. It's always been capable of being expropriated. And that the principle of expropriation, of permissible expropriation, is therefore not really controversial. What is sometimes controversial is what compensation should be paid, what procedure should be followed, and whether there are limits on the purposes for which expropriation may take place. But the principle of expropriation shouldn't be a controversial one. It's been part of our law as far as anyone can remember and everywhere else in the world. Similarly, I think it's important to clarify that expropriation legislation doesn't deal with who's going to get the land. The land goes in the first instance to the state. But if land is expropriated for land reform purposes, for example, for land redistribution, it's not the expropriation law or the expropriation process which will decide who will be the beneficiaries. That will be dealt with by the minister who's responsible for land reform. If land is expropriated for housing purposes, the purpose of the people, again, it's not the expropriating minister who decides who will get the houses. That's dealt with by the municipalities and the provincial governments who are responsible for allocating land for state-owned land for housing. And so one needs to separate conceptually the notion, the question of when may land be expropriated and what compensation and procedure are required from the question of who will get the land. So it's not, for example, it's not really so that land becomes liable to, land qualifies to be expropriated because it has been occupied or because it has been this or because it has been that. It always is potentially can be expropriated. The trigger is the trigger about compensation, which I'll come to. So then against that background, recognizing that expropriation is simply part of the ordinary law of every country in the world that I know of. There may be countries which don't have expropriation provisions in their law, but if they are, they are very unusual outliers. And recognizing that it's not the expropriator who decides, the expropriating authority who decides who gets the benefit, it's the State Department which is responsible. And I don't want to say anything about that. So then if I can go to this, against that background, to some of the questions which were raised, in relation to the question by the Honorable Sarisa, urgent expropriation is dealt with by clause in clause 22 of the bill. And urgent expropriations become available when something happens which was unanticipated and you need to get hold of the land for public purposes or public use very urgently. An easy example is when there's a flood. If there's a bad flood and something needs to be done on some land in order to reduce the flood, canals need to be dug, pipes need to be inserted, and some of this may be on private land. What urgent expropriation allows is it allows the state to move in to take the use of the property for a limited period while this disaster situation exists and while it's being addressed. So it's about those sorts of situations where there's a sudden and unexpected need, a disaster arises, a crisis arises, and private land needs to be used in order to solve the disaster or the crisis. And then Section 20 or Clause 22 acts, comes into play. And what Clause 22 provides is the following. Firstly, in Clause 22, subclause 1, it says it can only be, the use can only be expropriated. What one needs to note is it's not ownership was expropriated. What is expropriated is the right to use the property. And so an urgent expropriation can be carried out, which gives the right to use the property temporarily for not exceeding 12 months. And that's the usual limit. Then what it says in clause 22 sub 7, that if the expropriation authority wants to extend that beyond 12 months and the owner doesn't agree, then the expropriating authority can apply for an extension of the 12 months. And what clause 22.8 says is that extension can't be for more than 18 months. So it's ordinarily for 12 months. You can get a court to extend it, but a court can't extend it for more than 18 months. Then in relation to the supremacy clause, I agree respectfully with the honorable member that the use of that term is a bit confusing because it's the Constitution, of course, which is supreme. There is the supreme law of the country. But what this bill provides, which is quite commonplace, is it says this bill will apply to all expropriations. If there is an existing law which authorizes expropriation, that law must now be brought in, that expropriation must be done in accordance with this bill when it becomes an act. There are municipal ordinances, there are old provincial ordinances, there are many other laws which deal with expropriation, and many of them are inconsistent with the Constitution. What the so-called Supremacy Clause says is all other acts of Parliament dealing with expropriation are now subject to this act. But it doesn't put this act above the Constitution. The Constitution is, of course, the supreme law in all respects. So that the use of the term supremacy clause is with respect of a bit misleading. Then the question of Honourable Graham asked the question, if the land is not being used, who will decide whether this land is going to be expropriated, whether compensation will be paid, and so on? Well, the short answer is that if the court will have to decide whether if one's looking at the clause 12.3 provisions, which is what the Honourable Member was referring to, the ones which deal with possible nil compensation, it will be the court. If we could just go there, it's 12.3, which is on slide 16. This lists, if we can just deal with clause 12.3 as an example. One of the circumstances that may justify the payment of nil compensation is where the land is not being used, and the owner's main purpose is not to develop the land or use it to generate income, but to benefit from appreciation or its market value. If a dispute arises, a court will have to decide, firstly, does this land fall within this category? Is it land which is not being used and the owner's main purpose is to hold on to it to appreciate its market value? If yes, then the court will have to decide whether in this particular case that justifies nil market value. So in both the question of whether it falls inside the category, and if it does fall inside the category, whether nil compensation would be just and equitable, is a matter will be decided by the court. So, and one can go through all of those criteria, and in each case, the test is the question whether it falls within the categories for the court, and the amount of compensation is decided by the court. That's what Section 34 of our Constitution requires. So, and just to repeat what I said earlier, the failure to exercise control is not the test for whether the property is suitable for expropriation. It's a much broader test. Then the question of, with the question of the allocation of land, that the expropriation bill doesn't deal and never deals with the question of who will get the use of the land and control the land. That is dealt with by the body which will become the owner of the land, the national government, the province, or the local authority. Chairperson, I think I've dealt with all of the other legal questions. Some of them are policy questions, of course, which are not in my territory. Questions of other available land and so on. And I'd like to ask Advocate Naidu to deal with the question of public consultation, what public consultation is required on this bill.
Good morning, Madam Chairperson and honourable members of the committee. The short answer is that Section 59(1)(a) of the Constitution prescribes that Parliament, and in particular the National Assembly, must facilitate public involvement in all its legislative and other processes, not just before the Assembly itself, but also before its committees. This issue was dealt with by the Constitutional Court in 2018, I believe, when an Act of Parliament had been passed and public consultation had been facilitated. But when an Amendment Act was sought to be passed, following consultation at the committee level, an insertion was made into the Act to make it applicable to the veterinary profession, but the vets were not consulted. The Amendment Act was challenged successfully by the Veterinary Association of South Africa, and the Constitutional Court found that the National Assembly and its committees had failed to comply with their 59(1)(a) responsibilities. So the answer is that at least insofar as the new clauses are concerned, that's 12.3 and 12.4, public consultation would be mandatory, else the bill would be vulnerable to constitutional attack. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other additions or?
My hand is up.
Before you, Honorable Hicklin, I'm just checking with the minister and her team that there are no other responses. Okay, if then there are no other responses, Honorable Hicklin, yes. Except someone wanted to speak. Okay. Honorable Hicklin, followed by Honorable Van Staden, followed by Honorable Siwisa, and then we're taking the second round of questions and comments. Honorable Hicklin, followed by Honorable Van Staden, followed by Honorable Siwisa.
Thank you so much, Chair. Minister, I hear what you're saying about there being a broader grouping of people who are going to decide in inverted commas on whether land is being expropriated or not. But the point that I'm actually trying to make to you, Minister, and I am imploring you as the head of this department to ensure that our immovable asset register gets updated urgently, because until we have an appropriate, a comprehensive and a complete immovable asset register, we cannot begin the allocation, appropriate, proper, considered allocation of land. Right now, what we are doing is we're trying to push water up a hill, and it's flowing through our fingers because we don't have a clue exactly how much land we own and where. And until we get a comprehensive IAR, this process is doomed to failure. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, Minister.
Honourable Van Staden.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Now, I agree with Member Hicklin before me. It's very important to get that register up to date. Otherwise, we're going to pick up some problems in the future. Thank you for the answer about the public participation process. According to my view, it's necessary that the law be handling in that way, and that process be followed by that committee. But the Honourable Minister made a comment about, I think, the previous process had 50,000 comments on this bill. I know it's probably impossible to ask, but is it possible to give this committee, because most of us are new members of this committee, inputs in that comments from the previous round? Is it possible? Thank you.
Honorable Siwisa.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is based on Chairperson. I heard the response of the minister when she said that there were submissions that were made. And now when I go to her an extra A, it seems as if it's mostly board, it's entities. And I'm asking myself, when are we going to do? When are the people that are actually affected? Because we find that people on the ground, people in the rural areas, are they going to be consulted face-to-face to make their submissions? Because now we are talking about people that have access to internet. What about those ones that don't have access to internet? What is her taking on that one? Because those people are the ones that are going to be mostly affected by this whole thing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, honourable members, minister, and your team.
Thank you, honourable chairperson. To start with, honourable Siwisa, the public consultation must be undertaken by Parliament. It's mandatory. So as members of Parliament, you will decide how and where you are going to do the public participation, like it was explained by Advocate Naidu. So the image that we have provided was sort of a summary of the 50,000 which came in when the department, DPWI, gazetted the bill in December of 2018. But nothing stopped Parliament. In fact, you must do it, and the committee will decide how they are going to do it. I think just on the immovable asset register, it's not that we don't know where are the parcels of land that belongs to the state. The issues that was raised by the Auditor General for the past 4 or 5 years is that the way and how we determine the value of the land. And we've discussed this before when it comes to the value of the land. We have now had an agreement with the National Treasury that if we want to dispose land in terms of GIAMA, the Government Immovable Asset Management Act, that we will be allowed to use the municipal value. Now, also in GIAMA, it doesn't say that you must dispose land at a market value. It says it must be best value. And so that is sometimes also caused the delay of disposing of land. But there is a register, maybe 98% complete and another 2% that must still be added to the register. But we know where those parcels of land are. It's all over the country. And certainly, like we explained to members in the previous committee, that is one of the issues that is a priority for the department now, that we now need to put the land immovable asset register. We need to digitize it, we need to computerize it, and that is the process that has started now to put all of this on a computer so that we have a digitized immovable asset register. And the Auditor General has commended us for starting the process to digitize our immovable asset register. I've answered the one in public hearings. I think those were the two for me, Honorable Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. Okay.
Chairperson, if I can just add to the response on the assets register. In the last audit of the Auditor General, on the 5 assertions with respect to the auditability of the asset register, the existence of the assets, the completeness of the register, the rights and obligations, and the valuation, we were qualified on one item, which is the valuation. So the assets register was not qualified on issues of existence or completeness. So there's been a substantial improvement since that period of time that the Honourable Member is referring to, where certain assets could not be located. So I want to provide assurance that the assets register and quality has improved substantially since the particular incident referred to by the member. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister and Acting DG. In the absence of questions from the
one last question, Chair. Sorry,
the feds are, but this is the very last honourable speaker, so we continue. Yes. Okay.
Sorry for interruption. My question was not answered. Also.
Okay, Honourable Kobane's questions. She asked it on the first round of questions. She feels that it was not answered. Minister, first let's take Honorable Suhisa's comments. Yes, Honorable Suhisa?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you, Chair. Since we were taken through Section 25 of the Constitution, and I'm going to go specifically to 25 subsection 3B, where it says history of acquisition, that part only. What does the bill say if it is found out that the land was acquired? The acquisition was illegal. What does the bill say about if we are faced with such a, if the department is going to be faced with such a circumstance or something to do with Honorable Suhisa has acquired the land illegally. So what does the bill say in those instances? Thank you.
When responding, Honourable Minister, also explain Honourable Kopane's comment that she raised earlier on. Thank you.
Well, Honourable Chairperson, thank you. Honourable Kopane, please accept my apologies. Advocate Naidu dealt with the second part of your question, which was the public participation. The socioeconomic impact study, it's part of the legislative process that before a bill can be introduced to cabinet, the relevant ministry is required to send it to the Department of Public, the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation, to do a socioeconomic impact study. We can certainly provide the committee with their report from the DPME as part of your consideration. So my apology for that. I will make sure that the members receive that report from DPME. Thank you, Chairperson. And then the legal one from Honorable Suhisa can be answered by the legal team. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If I may answer it, the purpose of expropriation is to acquire ownership from the lawful owner or from those who hold informal rights. Expropriation doesn't deal with unlawful owners or unlawful holders because they don't have the right of ownership. The essence of expropriation is ownership is transferred from the current lawful owner to a new lawful owner, which it will become the state. And so if the land is illegally owned, if it's been stolen in some way, if there's some other illegality, then the remedy is not to expropriate the land, but the remedy is to reverse the illegality and to put the land back in the ownership of the person who's entitled to it. So it's not a question of illegal owners. I think when people talk about the use of the history of the acquisition of use, very often that's a reference to land which was acquired through forced removals. That's often what is in people's mind. Black people were removed from land, 3.5 million people were removed from land through forced removals. And where land was removed from, land was acquired through a forced removal, that is a fact which a court may consider relevant to deciding how much compensation would be just and equitable. You can look around Cape Town, particularly, not only Cape Town. Of course, it's now quite a long time ago, but there were situations where people profited from forced removal. And it would be possible to argue in a court that if you benefited and profited from forced removal, you should give up that benefit and profit. I think that's the sort of history of acquisition and use which is most commonly referred to. But it doesn't deal with illegal ownership is not ownership at all, and you don't have to be expropriated because if you're there illegally, you're not the owner. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Chairperson, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. Let me again appreciate the the clear presentation that was made to us as the committee. I think as the committee now, it's then up to us to take this forward as we indicated that this bill seeks to correct and reject the Expropriation Act of 1975, which we all agree that it is long overdue. It doesn't talk to the constitution that we adopted as the country in 1996. It talks to those apartheid laws. But we will then, as the committee, continue debating this, looking at the participation of the public, the comments that we will seek from the public, other than what you did as the executive. I think as the committee, we also have a role to play in taking this forward before it is adopted by the parliament. I really appreciate the presentation from yourself and your legal team. I think now, Ms. Nola, let's go to the second item of our agenda, and you are then free minister and the team to leave the meeting as we deal with other issues that relate maybe to the how do we take forward this as the committee. Ms. Nola?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I'm not sure if I can just proceed now or should I wait for the department to leave or we can just carry on.
No, carry on.
All right, thank you, Chair. According to Rule 2864I, the committee needs to adopt a motion of desirability, and this is obviously because we've just had a presentation from the department clarifying exactly all the clauses of the expropriation bill. So if I may, Honourable Chairperson, read Rule 2864I. It says, after due deliberation, the committee must consider a motion of desirability on the subject matter of the bill, and if rejected, must immediately table the bill and its report on the bill. So around this time, Chairperson, I would like to request you to call for the mover for the adoption of the motion of desirability of this bill, and thereafter a seconder. And if there's any opposing view, then we'll record that on the minutes. Or rather call for a vote if in an event where there's a need for a vote. Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Nola, I apologize for that. As I'm preparing for the sitting, remember public works will also be part of this debate. Can you just repeat the last part of this issue of the vote?
All right, I was saying, Honourable Chairperson, that you would call for a mover for the adoption of the desirability of the bill, and then thereafter a seconder. And if there's any opposing view, then we can always call for a vote, Honourable Chair. I see Ms. Ngema has raised her hand. I'm not sure whether it's deliberate or perhaps you can give her a chance to speak. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, Honourable Members, Ms. Ngema is from the Parliament Legal Services, who is attached to our committee. I think let's give her to speak. Ms. Ngema?
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to all the Honourable Members and everybody present. Chairperson, I just thank you for noting me. I just wanted to add an important part on the question of public participation, which does not derail from what they have said and what Ms. Nola was currently dealing with in terms of the desirability of the bill. But Chairperson, I just thought I need to point out this crucial fact. The bill that is before the committee right now, in its entirety, is introduced and open to public participation, not only with the reservations to those two that I knew, which were not part of the Remitted bill. The entire bill, every clause that is in the current bill is now open to public participation, and every part of it must then be taken through the process and not only be restricted to those that were mentioned as the new, but focus could then be streamlined to those specifically that are new and maybe give it more attention.
Thank you,
and give it more attention. So that is basically what I needed to point out in alignment with what the department indicated, as well as taking forward the process on the desirability and the processes of taking the bill through its legislative process. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Nyama. I think you have assisted us a lot. I think I saw Honorable Graham's hand and Honorable Van Skalvik's hand up. Please note, Honorable Members, Honorable Van Skalvik is not well. So when she speaks, she may not speak as we are used to her speaking. But her hand is up. Honorable Graham Mare.
Thank you, Chair Shem. I'm sorry to hear that Honorable Van Skalvik isn't well. I hope it's nothing serious. Just with respect to this whole process, so we're being asked now to vote on the desirability of this bill as it stands, and then at what point do we determine whether or not we are going to proceed with public participation? So do we have to vote on the desirability first and then put it through for public participation, or can we insist that the public participation happens before the desirability part of it? Sorry if I'm being ignorant, but I've never done this before, so I really, really would like some clarity.
Thank you, Honourable Graham Murray. Honourable Van Skalvik.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, everyone. I would like to move for the motion of desirability in favour of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Van Skalvik. Honourable Van Skalvik is moving for the desirability. Can I get a second before Nola explains to Honorable Graham Murray the process that we're going to follow? We need first to agree on the desirability, Honorable Graham Murray. Can I get a second on what Honorable Van Skalvik has moved? Honorable Njoba?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, members. I'd like to support Honorable Van Skalvik.
Thank you, Honorable Njoba. We've got a mover and a seconder. Honorable Ms. Martinez, can you explain to Honorable Graham Murray why we had to start by first adopting this desirability part before we apply the process? Can you do that? I understand that Ms. Ngema tried, but can you, because there is also a process which has not yet been tabled. I suspect that the reason Honorable Graham Murray is asking those questions is because the process that has to be followed has not been clearly tabled so that we understand what is going to be done. Can you then come in, Ms. Martinez?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Just to come in and respond to Honourable Graham Murray's question, or rather concern, that if you remember, Honourable Members, there was a presentation that was done on how to process legislation in its entirety, which is then the process that will follow while processing this bill. And Rule 286 clearly outlines what process needs to be followed. And as the Honourable Chairperson has alluded, I will then zoom into the actual process according to our draft project plan that we've drafted as the support personnel of this committee, which was tabled to MENCO yesterday. So prior to that, we thought we should rather start with the motion of desirability. So this is part of the process that needs to be followed. It's a formality that is required as per Rule 286.1 that I read. So Honorable Graham Murray, we need to do this process, get this over and done with, and then zoom into the draft project plan, in which we are outlining all the activities that will follow throughout the project. Thanks, Shepperton.
I just hope that Honorable Graham Murray is satisfied with the explanation that you have given, Ms. Martinez. Can we then, having moved and adopted the desirability, can we move then? Now, Ms. Martinez.
Thanks, Chair. I would like, before we move to the minutes, I would like to just share the draft project plan so that we can take members through it and to also exactly allay the fears that members would have. And obviously, because this is a new committee, so as previously stated during our presentation, we did say that we'll take members through each and every step of the process that we'll have to follow. First and foremost, in this draft plan, we have color-coded our tasks. The green tasks are tasks that have already been completed during this during the processing of the bill. The orange one would be tasks that are not yet completed but are currently underway. And then the red ones, which we don't currently have, would have been then tasks that would not have been completed. So at this point, we're still going well. We're still doing fine according to our projected timelines. The white areas are areas that are yet to be completed, which would be highlighted as pending. So if I may, Honourable Chairperson, I'll start with the first one. The introduction and tabling of the bill was done HSC 145 2020 on the 14th of October as per the presentation by the department. So that would then appear as completed. So the second one, Honourable Chair, was the process planning, which I've just referred to, which was a presentation that was done by ourselves, the support personnel of the committee, in which we produced the briefing notes and the presentation on the 26th of October. And that would also be flagged as completed, it was also highlighted green. Thereafter, the bill was tagged as a Section 76 bill through the JTM, which Ms. Ngema is part of. That was done on the 29th of October. After that, the bill was referred to the National House of Traditional Leaders through our Bills Office. This was done ATC 161 2020 by Mr. Neil Bell from our Bills Office, and it was done on the 6th of November this year. So the reason why you see that under that one task, there are two tasks that are supposed to be completed there, which is one, the referral, which was done on the 6th of November. Now, we are awaiting the submission of the NHTL comments, which is the National House of Traditional Leaders comments. They're supposed to submit the documents to us by the 6th of the 12th month of the 12th month of 2020, because they get given 30 days to respond and give us their comments after the bill has been referred to them. So today we've just had the briefing by the department on the expropriation bill. So that will also, after this meeting, be flagged as a completed task because it was done today. The motion of desirability, which we've also just done, we have adopted the motion of desirability. That will also be updated after today's meeting as a completed task. Then moving over to the topic of interest, public participation, we will therefore, after today's meeting, call for public comments through radio, print and social media. We will advertise and safe to say, Honourable Chairperson, there is a process that we have to follow in terms of supply chain management, in which we'll have to process the advertisement. When the advertisement has been put out, we will give 60 days to the public to submit their comments. And this decision was taken during Manco yesterday, that because of the timing upon which we'll send the advert out, which should be 4th of December, many people are already not in the office, either due to COVID-19, and some of which during the December period will be at home and will not have access to their emails and whatnot. So the Manco then decided that we should give the public at least 60 days to respond, which should lapse on the 4th of the second month in the coming year, that is 2021. After this call for public comments, then we'll also consider oral submissions. As we know, Honourable Members, some of the stakeholders would be more comfortable submitting oral submissions to Parliament, and that we have scheduled for the week of the 9th of February until the 12th of February next year. After we've considered all of those, Honourable Chairperson, we'll then roll out public hearings in provinces, with the first one being Limpopo and the last one being the Western Cape, as the list goes. So we have not yet allocated specific dates on this one, Honorable Chair, as this was tabled yesterday at Menco, and the decision was that we should go back to our calendar and see the framework of Parliament as well, because we need to take that into consideration. However, a proposal which the Menco was in favour of was that, first and foremost, the committee will not be split into two. We will deal wholly with the public hearing. So the whole committee will travel to provinces, and the target is 4 days per province, four areas per province. So that's why then the dates would have not been flagged into the draft project plan as yet, because we need to take all those things into consideration. And thereafter, we'll submit the final draft to the committee for further consideration. We are looking, Honorable Chairperson, to submit the report on the expropriation bill at least by the 30th of June in 2021. So that's when the final report will be tabled to the House, as we are projecting. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I'm not sure if the members would probably have questions in this regard.
Okay, I think Mr. Martinez, this should be an item that we debate as the committee, because the proposal that you're bringing, especially the white area, not the one that has been done there, it's a proposal that we did as the management committee of the portfolio committee. Then it's brought to the committee to adopt it or maybe to comment on the issues. The reason, honourable members, I think Ms. Martinez has just indicated that instead of 30 days, are we calling for public comments? We felt that it must be 60 days, knowing how busy December is, people going to their rural areas where they don't have internet. All these gadgets are not working for them to submit their comments and all that. That is why we felt that. And having learned lessons from the ad hoc committee of Section 25 amendment, where there was a call for public comment in December, people commented and complained that you can't call for public comment in December. It has then had to be extended up to the end of January or mid-February. That is why we felt that it must be 60 days. But then let me call for comments on this, honorable members. Honorable Van Staden, it's only your hand that is up on this issue. Other honorable members, they're not here. Honorable Van Staden.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. On the call for public comments, and as you said now, that December can be a problem, but I hear you, it's December and January for comments. Why not rather start the process for 60 days in January, for January and February, when it cancels this problem of the Christmas season in December? Just a note from my side.
Thank you, Honorable Van Staden. No other comments from the honorable members on this plan? Ms. Martinez?
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Interesting that that question is coming up. Honorable Chair, as I said earlier, that this is a draft plan of the Portfolio Committee. So we really depend on the Portfolio Committee to state whether this plan is acceptable as it is, or rather there are amendments that we should make thereof. Like, for instance, if the committee takes the decision right now that Honorable Van Staden's proposal should stand, then we'll go back and change the dates as per the requirements of the Portfolio Committee, because this remains a draft program of the Portfolio Committee. Thanks, Chair.
Honorable Njobo? Honorable Njobo?
Yes, Chairperson.
Your hand is up.
Yes, Chair.
Okay, over to you then.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. If I may, I like to support Honorable Van Staden to move to January.
Okay. Then I think there is no objection on that, Ms. Martinez. Then on the issue of calling for public comments, I don't know which date then are we going to use for January. When are we going to advertise? It means then the process of advertising, you must work on it over the December holidays. Then in January, let's say 4th of January, then the advert is out for calling for public comment. Then is it going to be 30 days or 60 days again?
Honorable Chair?
Yes.
If I may.
Yes. Let's take
before,
yeah,
Honorable Njoba. Yes, Chairperson. Before Unola, the 60 days, if possible, can we continue with 60 days?
Yeah, that was the intention, Chair. Sorry to chip in now. But I said if we don't use December, then we stick to the 60 days for January and February. Although February's just got 28 days, then we just carry on, say, as you said, from the 4th of January to the 4th of March, when it will probably cover the 60 days. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Let me come in, Honourable Members. The reason we had 60 days, it was because there is December holiday. That's why we then say it can't be the 30 days, but it's 4th of December to 4th of January. That's why we had to add another 30 days to make it 4th of February. If you're saying then this advert must then go out in January, I think we have to go back to 30 days. That is the normal way of doing things. Remember, this bill is of the public interest in the majority of the population of this country. So to me, we have presented a plan here that says that we would want, as the portfolio committee, to ensure that it is tabled by the end of June. So if then we moving this to maybe even, remember, we'll start only with the public hearings after the call for comments has closed. We don't do both at the same time. So that means if we're saying 4th of March, it would then mean we will start with the public hearing mid-March towards end March. And remember, we are going to go to 9 provinces. When then will we finish that? That means then the 30th of June is also out. I think we also need to look at that. That's my take on this, but I'm not finalizing. Ms. Martinez and I think Ms. Ngema, our legal person, should also come in on this one. Over to you.
Thanks, Chair. Just to assist the portfolio committee, the normal time frame that is usually given is 30 days for public comment. However, I think it will assist the committee if we can advertise now, so that we can maximize on the people that will be able to submit the public comments right away, like in December, and then extend it to January as it currently stands on the draft project plan. Unless then the committee says we should advertise in January or end of January, then we carry on like that. But I think it'll really assist us to have the 2 months time frame for the public comments, because some people will, in all honesty, be able to submit their public comments right away, and some will only be able to do so in January. I think, Chairperson, that'll be my submission for now.
Ms. Ngema, anything from your side before I finalize on this matter? Ms. Ngema?
Yeah, I think Mangema is driving, so maybe you can keep her.
Okay. Ms. Njoba, your hand was up, or you?
I think, Chair, let's go back to square one.
Let's start on the sentence. Let's go back then to the original one.
I'm trying to follow you on Facebook while I also follow the other meeting on transport. So I just have to try and quickly come back. The issue you have raised, basically, Chairperson, I think it's on point. And in order to ensure that we do not create any flaws or any room for contestation, we must definitely give it the time and as well as allow every form of issues without looking so much on how we do things. So I do suggest, Chairperson, as you have indicated, that we must separate the time calling for submissions as well as the time when we start the public hearings themselves. So the 2 months that you suggested is looking good. And in terms of the time frame, generally, it is the committee that sets its own time frame. I am aware that with the NCOP, they have set a specific 6-week cycle, but that does not really impact so much on the NA processes because in terms of the rules of the National Assembly and its portfolio committees, the timeframes are not set on how much and how much time must be taken for public participation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Ngema. Thank you. Ms. Martinez, the challenge now, the two honorable members have withdrawn their debate. Ms. Martinez, mine would be to ask you that to shift the date of the advert. Maybe so that we allow enough time, it not be the 4th. Of December, we can I don't know when you're closing, but I understand that we may close, but the parliament doesn't actually close. Work continues even when we're not there. I would propose that maybe on the I don't know when the 10th is. The advert goes out on the 10th of December. So it's 10th of December to 10th of January, then 10th of January to 10th of February, these 60 days. I'm thinking maybe the reason honorable members are calling on this, they know that the 15th, the 4th of December, people are still on the holiday mood. Though I don't know whether we're going to have holiday when we have a second wave of COVID-19 attacking us so aggressively right now. So I'm just proposing that, honorable members, if you allow us, that it not be 4th of December, say 10th of December to 10th of January. I know some of the people will submit their comments even during that time, but again, then the majority, at least 10th of January to 10th of February, we allow a lot of people to be in their offices, to be at work, to be able to link through the electronic gadgets and have internet. That is my proposal on this, and then we start other processes after the 10th of February. But still keeping in mind that, or maybe we can even shift to that one, say end of July, not end of June, Ms. Martinez said, end of June, we end of July, we then table this to the parliament.
Noted, Chairperson. We'll make such adjustments to the program and revert to the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Martinez. I think that is all about the program now. Please note, honorable members, there will be only one team going out to all the provinces. I think in January we will come back to the members so that they indicate. But as we have seen, we will be starting in in Limpopo, Mpumalanga. I think you've seen the program. We won't change that, and we will finalize that, but we're looking at doing what has been done by the other committees, the NHI, the Section 25 ad hoc committee, where four venues or four regions or four districts are visited during these public hearings. Four per province, and then starting at Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and the last one will be Western Cape. That is the program. Then I think we're going to minutes now, Ms. Martinez.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The first minutes that are before the Committee for Consideration and Adoption are the minutes of a meeting that was held on the 17th of November, where we had the beautiful R briefings, the AG, DPWI, PMTE, and all the entities. I would now request the honourable members to just zoom into the attendance register to check if there's any anomaly that we need to fix. And in the absence thereof, we'll just zoom into the deliberations as well as the resolutions of that meeting.
Honourable members, those are the minutes of our last meeting. I'm then inviting comments and corrections from all the members.
Yes, my apology for this meeting, Matt. I don't see it. I normally make apology via the WhatsApp.
And that one is very clear. You are the only person that doesn't fail to make an apology.
Chairperson?
Yes, Honorable.
Yes. Do you remember I connected and then because of the problem of connection, I disconnected several times there. So I don't know. Yes.
Okay. Your apologies there, Honorable Kopane. Oh, Honorable Van Staden was part of.
Yeah, no, sorry. No, sorry. I'm democratic. Oh, no, sorry, ma'am.
Okay. Any information on the discussions, honourable members, on the actual minutes? Honourable members, on the actual minutes? Can I then get a move? Yes, Honourable Njobo?
On my side, everything is okay. I can move the adoption.
Honourable Njobo is moving for the adoption of the minutes. Can I get a second, honourable members? Can I get a second, honourable members, on the
chair? But honourable Samantha has her hand up.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Apologies. Honourable Graham Murray, your hand is up.
Oh, thanks, Chair. I was just putting my hand up to say that I'm happy to second Honourable Njobo's adoption of the minutes.
Thank you, Honourable Graham Murray. The minute, the seconded to the motion to move for the adoption. Can we go to the second set of minutes? Ms. Martinez?
All right, Chair, I'm going to it now. The other challenge that we usually experience, Chairperson, just as I'm trying to open the other set of minutes, can honourable members please keep us updated? Like, for instance, we usually get apologies, then we record the apologies, and later you see the honourable members joined in the meeting, either towards the end or whatever. Can the honourable members please update us if they're now going to be coming into the meeting, because then it creates such a confusion. Where a member is recorded as absent or rather having apologized, yet they come into the meeting and we're not aware. Right? All right, thank you, Chair. I'll move into the meeting of the 18th of November, where we were considering and adopting the BRRR 2019-20, and then we considered and adopted other minutes of previous meetings. There again, Honourable Chair, I'd like the Honourable members to just check if their attendance is captured correctly, or if there were any apologies thereof.
Ms. Martinez, the minutes, they not yet showing on our screens.
Oh, let me just try and go back into a chair because they are showing on my side. Apologies about that. Let me just try again. Are they now showing?
Yes.
All right, thanks, Chair.
Yes.
I would like to request the honourable members to check the attendance register if it's been properly captured.
That was this meeting. It's correct. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Staden had apologized for that meeting where he was not in. So we move over.
But it doesn't matter. But for this meeting, Honourable Tring had apologized, but later came on and discussed in the meeting and debated, but okay, it doesn't matter. We have shown her as having attended the meeting. I think you when with your earlier comments, maybe you're referring to that.
Yes, Chair.
Any on the issue of the minutes, Honourable Members? I'm not checking this issue now. Can I get an honourable member who is going to move for the adoption of the minutes?
Coco, no, ma'am.
Chairperson, I move the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you, Honourable Mjobo. A seconder for the mover?
I'll second, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Honourable Hicklin, for seconding the motion. I think the minutes have been then adopted. Any other business, Ms. Martinez?
Nothing else from my side, Chair, apart from the announcement that next week is our last meeting on the 2nd of December, in which we'll be getting a briefing from the DPWI on the status of the implementation of our oversight recommendations. Remember, we had two major oversight visits, one to Bay Bridge and the second one to Kosi Bay, that is the Jersey barrier. So we then submitted the recommendations through the speaker to the minister. So then we would like to, as a committee, follow up on the implementation of those recommendations. We have deliberately omitted the most recent oversight visit recommendations, which is Acacia Park and Pelican Park, jointly parliamentary villages. Obviously, because the House hasn't heard that report, and therefore we can't then expect the minister to have implemented any of those resolutions. Even though we know that the committee felt that some of the recommendations don't need to wait for that process to take place, but as a matter of procedure, it would be unfair for us to expect them to report on the implementation at this point. So we're only getting the implementation, the status report on the implementation on only two major oversight reports that we submitted to the minister.
Thank you, Ms. Nola. I think that last meeting that we will be having, we really need to have that and check those recommendations. Remember, we discussed the reports of those oversight visits and we had clear recommendations. Tomorrow we will be dealing with the first and second quarterly reports, né? Ms. Martinez, do we have the documents yet?
Yes, Chair, the documents were submitted. I saw them earlier in my inbox.
Okay, so you're still going to send them to us, eh?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. I believe other members in the sitting today, there will be deliberations and declarations on the our BRRR report. All the best to all those that will be presenting declarations on behalf of their political parties from this committee. I know there's definitely going to be some fireworks, as we always do. But always, I appreciate the really, honourable members, I really appreciate the way we engage as this committee.
I've said this several times, but it is good to chair a committee where there are no fireworks. There can be fireworks in Parliament, but we don't need fireworks here. We don't have a fire extinguisher in the committee where there is a serious exchange of words and blows as it is happening in other committees. We really know that we all here on the ticket of being public representatives. And as such, us exchanging blows is not good for those people that are listening to us, for those people that voted for us to be here in Parliament. Let's continue doing the good work and engaging in a manner that also assists the person who is listening to us to understand where we want to go, what are we trying to discuss in this meeting. Thank you again. Let's meet in the plenary at 2. Ms. Martinez, I thank you again to our A team. Our A team is doing well. The meeting is adjourned, honorable members. Thank you.
Farewell. Bye.
Thank you so much. Bye, everybody.
Bye.